This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
Welcome everybody to Cinematica Animalia, the podcast where we take somebody's favourite movie monster and break down how they would work in terms of their physiology and ecology. Today we are looking at the BGWMs from 2010 or 11, so I've already forgotten, that's a good start. Attack the Block.
2011,
good to know. Okay, but before we get into that, my name is Sam Perrin. I am a PhD student at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology. And I write at ecologyforthemasses.com. With me today is podcast host number one, Adam Kashish. It's Lebanese in origin. And our friend Dave. Who's a veterinarian who wishes to remain anonymous because he shagged a porpoise and is on the run from
the Chilean government.
These were much more fun when we just applied them to TJ at the beginning of the episode.
Yes, well, fair enough.
You're now the TJ of the podcast.
Oh, God.
How's it going?
Not bad. A lot of actual candidacy, like real PhD students do, is coming up and your boy's dying.
Yeah, you've got to sit that candidacy exam, don't you?
Two of them.
So last week we had a conference in my hometown on the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, mercifully referred to normally as IPBES. So Ipswich, yes, that's what they're generally called too. Anyway, Ipswich are all about like converting scientific knowledge into policy, that sort of thing, which is something I'm very, very keen on because, you know, we do all this scientist work. The ecological science has typically been a very insular profession. Most sciences in general, like there's not a lot of outreach, especially within academia. So this was really interesting. Like the reports that they produce, these massive assessment reports, that take in comments from like thousands of researchers worldwide, and they churn one of these out about every 3 or 4 years to hand out to government end users, policymakers for climate change, biodiversity assessment, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And one of the messages that stuck with me from it was this guy called Carsten Rabeck, who works at the Museum of Natural History in Copenhagen. Which is a fantastic natural history museum, by the way. The amount of space they've got is not much, but I mean, what they do with it, they've got like a whale fetus and a whale heart. They've got a bunch of really cool like exhibitions. It's fantastic, yeah. No, what he was saying was that we focus so much on climate change that, I mean, people think that this is the biggest threat to species, biodiversity, that sort of thing. It's not at all. Like fragmentation, land use, that sort of stuff. He was talking about something like 60% of species that have been wiped out have been wiped out because of land that was cleared to make space for meat-based diets, like cattle farming, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yep.
Two other stats which are amazing. Like, out of the land mammal biomass on Earth, what percentage of that do you think is wild animals?
It's got to be something ridiculously small.
Less than 5.
It's tiny. 4%, yeah. 60% is cattle, and we're the other 36%. It's insane.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Sucks, but...
Oh, there's bear creatures chasing us! Big alien gorilla wolf motherfuckers, I swear!
Right. So, Attack the Block is a film that came out in 2011. When this came out, I used to love these kind of... the project-based British young adult films back in the day. There's this fantastic movie called Kidulthood, which stars Mickey Smith from Doctor Who as this... Noel Taylor is the actor's name. As this really rough-and-tumble gangster-type kid who's involved in this kind of scuffle, ongoing rivalry with this bunch of kids. And it is exactly the same as Attack the Block in a lot of ways, but Attack the Block had aliens, which was fucking great.
It's a really tight, really well done movie.
Oh, it's so good.
It's so good. It's 80 minutes. You can put it on. You can smash through it. Adam and I watched this in Helgoland, I think it was.
Yeah, I think so.
In any case, what happens is there's these five kids in the projects, or the P's, as it's referred to, in the east side of London.
The Block.
The Block, yes. Quite a kind of rundown area.
The Block in the Ends.
Yeah, Block in the Ends. And these monsters attack, and we essentially have a film of five rowdy British youths set up against a gang of aliens with kind of a social...
commentary.
Social inequity commentary in the background, which I think works really well in this movie.
It does. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they put it in there really subtly, especially when he's the white kid in the group is talking to... Is it Jodie Whittaker? Is that her name?
Jodie Whittaker, the doctor, yeah.
Yeah. Nurse.
No, Dave, I mean she is the doctor now.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. And he's talking to her about how her partner's in Ghana helping the African kids. He's like, what, you can't help the British kids?
Yeah.
It's like, ooh.
Yeah. It works really well. I would say one of my criticisms of this film is that those kids aren't sympathetic enough.
No, you don't feel bad when some of them get eaten.
Yeah, these creatures are really interesting. Like, they're very intimidating.
It's a really cool design. Like
they're horrifying. Yeah, it is a fascinating design. They're referred to constantly as the big gorilla wolf motherfuckers.
Oh, and it changes. Sometimes it's bear, sometimes it's alien. Yeah. But yes, I do like the big gorilla wolf
motherfuckers. Say alien again.
Yeah.
Hi, Hat.
What is it that... Nick Frost is in this movie.
Yeah. Oh, he's so good, yeah.
The weed boy.
Congratulations, kids. You found a species unknown to human, possibly not terrestrial in origin, and you fucking kicked its head in.
Yeah. I like when that the stoned uni kid is hiding under the bush, and Nick Frost looking out the window with his binoculars. He's like, oh no. And kid's like, what? What? I said, shop's closed.
Yeah. Also, Nick Frost describes them as looking like a monkey fucked a fish.
That's
the female at the very start, though. That's an interesting point, though, before we actually get into the physiology of these things, is that the females and the males look very different. Like, there is one female who arrives at the start. The movie heavily implies that she has left a pheromone trail, which the males then follow. The main character, Moses, plays by John Boyega, has this sort of crap all over him, so they're following him around for most of the movie.
And we are led to believe the other kids had it all over them too, that were attacked
the ones
and
killed
by
murked.
These creatures.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Murked. Good.
Murked is
good,
a good word.
Yeah.
Trust, bruv.
What else? What else should we touch on before we let Dave take over on the physiology?
For the movie itself, I mean, for like younger actors, I think they do a really, really good job of.
Yep.
You don't, you don't think these are annoying, especially like Props and Mayhem. You don't think about them being annoying kids. Like, they're just
so good.
These kids, you believe these kids are real.
Yeah. And old mate, he's now big in he's become Jefferson. No, Firestorm. Is it Firestorm in DC's Legends of Tomorrow?
Holy shit! Yeah, he is.
Yeah.
Yeah, he grew up in Jefferson.
The one who gets his head ripped off early on.
Oh, okay.
What?
Huh.
Whoa, yeah. Whoa.
Dennis?
Whoa.
Jefferson Jackson and Martin Stein are played by Franz Drame. Yeah, he's also in Edge of Tomorrow. Good actor, that one. I like him.
Yeah.
Anyway, we should get moving on. These things, like I said, they're shown to be adept climbers. They're quite chunky. Okay. Dave, you want to take over here and tell us about the physiology?
Sure. Do we need to comment on if we liked the film or not?
I think it's probably obvious at this point that we all really like the film.
We loved this film. It was a great film.
On the roof, if you don't believe me.
What? What's on the roof?
One of them.
Say it.
One of them big gorilla wolf motherfuckers.
So before we let Dave get started on the physiology, we just want to say same sort of thing as we did with the Quiets in season one. These are extraterrestrial, of course. But it's no fun if we just say, look, there's a ton of different systems that work in other planets, so we've got to try and make these things work on Earth-based systems. So that's what we'll be using mainly off. Anyway, Dave, go for it.
Yeah, so just a general overview, exactly as Sam was saying, there is a big distinction between the male and females. The females are small. They look to be about sort of 10, maybe at most 20 kilograms. They seem to be able to be lifted by the kids fairly easily. It's sort of unclear if they need both hands or one hand. They can kind of drag it along. It's almost completely hairless. We get a quick look at its dentition, and it's got this sort of like very mild carnivorous dentition, but it doesn't look well defined. It almost looks like juvenile. They produce a foul smell, which we later learn in the film is some sort of pheromone-based, or we're led to believe that. They have no eyes whatsoever, which is a common feature between both the males and females. They don't appear to be all that resistant. I mean, they're killed by teenage kids with, like, teenage weapons. So these are not incredibly dense, strong creatures. And the material that it seems to produce does glow under a fluorescent or UV light. Now, the males, on the other hand...
The teeth seem to glow by themselves.
Well, for the males, the female doesn't have any glowing teeth. We get to see that. I watched it a couple of times. Like, it's just, she doesn't have any other glowing feature with the exception of her entire body glows under a fluorescent light. At least in spots. Now, the males are, there are multiple of them. They're huge. I briefly did their weights over, but I can't imagine that they're going to be anything less than 120 kilograms, and they might get up to 160 kilograms. They're big, they're muscled. They do appear to have glowing teeth. They've got dark fur, like the darkest fur. It almost absorbs, or it does absorb light around it. They, again, have no obvious eyes, sharp claws, sort of these big three digits on both forelimbs. They, again, can be killed with conventional weapons, firearms, that kind of thing, but they're pretty resilient. They're fast. They're clocking in speeds, I'd say, probably around sort of a dog speed, kind of like top 45 miles per hour. Like, they're booking it. They're keeping up with the motorized transport. They can't really, like, straight out catch up and overwhelm a human that's running, but they catch up to it, and they're competing with the bicycle and everything else. And interesting enough, they also vocalize a lot. They scream, they yell, they vocalize in anger, they vocalize
constantly.
In pain.
Constantly.
Yeah. Now...
Which is odd, because we've gone through this. We might have talked about this in the context of Jurassic Park, but very often they will vocalize when they're chasing someone.
Yeah.
Now, for anybody who's... That makes no sense whatsoever. There is no point whatsoever in A, letting your prey know where you are, and B, expending extra energy while you're chasing after something. It doesn't make sense.
Now, I didn't get into any method by which they're sensing the world around them, because I feel like we've done that pretty well in quiets and other things like that. They don't have quite the ears for ultrasound. I don't think the screaming makes sense, although it could be some form of basic echolocation that they're doing to try and navigate the world.
I have a
different
theory about where the echolocation could be coming from, but I think that vocalization just might be tied into this. We'll get into this in the ecology section, but they could be in rut, and so this is just a hormone-crazed monster at the moment that cannot behave on its normal function.
And I think they are tracking primarily based on smell and sound is going to be the primary method that they're moving around. Now, just as a brief note, we've talked on this before. They arrive via space, or at least that's what we're led to believe. They crash down onto the planet. They strike there, and then they emerge as fully grown creatures. They can't do that. We've talked about this before. You can't survive in the vacuum of space as completely intact. Now, a little bit strange, we do see one of them that seems to have crashed down and didn't... is sort of almost fossilized in a shell when they take a look at it. Yeah. It's in this asteroid. The shell itself looks metal, and it almost looks carved out to hold the creature. So Sam and Adam will get a little bit more...
There's an exact impression of its face on there.
Right. Yeah. So Sam and Adam will get a little bit more into this. But in terms of this, asteroids strike the Earth with a lot of force. It's a really big deal when they strike the Earth.
A meteorite strikes
don't.
The Earth.
Right. These things strike down, they hit a car, and they leave, like, an impact, but there's no big explosion, they're not creating any blast radius, there isn't anything like that. Yep. So, I'm wondering if whether or not this shell kind of thing that they're flying through the air has some sort of mechanism that's activated when re-entering the atmosphere, sort of getting warmed up and starting to break down before they strike the Earth, and there's got to be some sort of cushion material or something to absorb the impact, such that when they strike, the creature inside, which is pretty weak, it can be killed with conventional firearms and conventional tools, is protected, but the shell breaks apart, allowing for the creature to emerge. And then the whole reason it doesn't create these big impact craters is because if it did, it would have to strike with the same amount of force to kill the creature inside. Yeah. So there's got to be something absorbing impact. Now, the cool bit, I'm just going to focus on the two big things that are a lot more fun to sort of go through in this. One being the pheromones, two being the glowing teeth. And Sam and Adam will get excited and jump in where they want to.
Because it's a pretty, for anybody who thinks there's going to be some massive issues this week, there's not really. This is
no.
A pretty...
It looks like it's about the size of a bear. It moves kind of like a bear / gorilla at different points. It climbs. It does a whole bunch of different things. It has claws. I didn't have a lot of problems. It voraciously eats. Now, the pheromones, they're traveling and tracking huge distances to try and find those that are covered in the pheromones, but not unrealistic distances. We've got lots of areas in nature in terms of usually within the insect kingdom where animals can travel long distances detecting pheromone signals. So silkworms can travel up to 30 miles to find a female. The males can, traveling and basically following a pheromone trail in the air. And they've been doing work on a number of different moth families and found that they can detect up to a few hundred molecules of pheromones in a cubic centimeter of air. Like, it doesn't take a lot. Now, I don't think that they can actually find the female in this, because she appears to be hidden away in that giant weed room, and they're not going after the weed room right at the bat. They're going after the kids who are covered in that smell.
Yeah.
I think they're navigating based on smell, and we talked about this. I think they have a really sensitive olfactory system, so they're going to have a very complex system for picking up these types of smells. And they're most likely also going to have a secondary system in place, something called a vomeronasal organ. It's something that humans have. It's something that we see a lot of other mammals have. It's a much more sensitive sense organ for trying to pick up these things and catch them within distance. So, yeah, Sam?
Yeah, you get a pretty good close-up of the female's face, right?
Yeah.
You don't see the male's face at all. The female doesn't seem to have any kind of large nostrils whatsoever.
No, but I don't think she's going to be the primary means for detection, for smell, for anything like that. I don't think she...
Okay,
I think
good.
She's going to have food provided by the males. I think she's going to be taken care of. If there are so few...
Could they also
I think
be
this
in the mouth itself?
They could be, and that's where the vomeronasal, like they're further back in some species. You don't necessarily need a huge nose or anything like that for detection. It helps, but it's not exactly like moths have giant noses or a lot of other insects. It just depends on how you build your chemical receptors in your detection system and how specific that you're being. I don't know if these guys would necessarily have a whole wide range of different smells or if they would just have very specific, because they don't really seem to pay attention to the nurse when she's not covered in the pheromones. They just really want anything with that pheromone smell. And they're just wrecking everything in between. Now, the fluorescence under UV light. Interestingly enough, scorpions and a couple of other species that are found on Earth naturally glow when we put a UV light over top of them. We don't know why. There's been a whole bunch of different theories. But one of the theories that's emerged and I think applies in this situation, it's just incidental. It's just one of those things that, like, the female just glows. There's no specific reason why she glows. She's just glowing because it's happened. It just has to do with the chemical residue creates a glowing smell. So the much more cool mechanism and the one that I want to put a lot more energy into was the glowing teeth. So biofluorescence, the idea that things glow, we see this in a whole bunch of different species, the firefly being one of our best examples. Sam is a big fan of the anglerfish. This bioluminescence...
I do love a pretty lady.
It's usually the result of combining different chemical compounds known as luciferins and luciferases. And sort of when the two are added, you get this system where you give off light. Now, the really interesting thing is it's a very cool reaction because it's been generated in such a way that it gives off light without generating a huge amount of heat. Because the last thing that you want to be doing is basically creating this really hot, angry, warm area while you're trying to generate light, because that's going to burn you and it's going to burn the surrounding tissues. Now, you normally need a specialized chamber to hold these types of reactions in. And this is where I get into sort of a mild issue, but I think I can make it work with the glowing teeth. Now, these teeth that we see attached to these creatures, they're sharp. They're happening in rows. We open up our
almost
mouth
down
multiple
the throat
times. Yeah.
Yeah.
and we see these big rows happening, and they seem to glow. Now, really interesting side point, when the creature dies during the film, the teeth stop glowing. Like, the reaction comes down, and it sort of goes to a medium. Now, this is really cool, because it actually fits with the mechanism that I want to make this work with. So I don't think the teeth themselves actually have any glowing organ built inside of them. Teeth need to be built for strength. They're composed of an outer core, your sort of crown and your dentin that makes up the outside of them. And then on the inside, you've got your standard pulp chamber with your nerve and with your vessels and everything like that. Now, interesting enough, sharks don't really have an inner core. Their teeth are designed strictly for the purpose of just tearing and destroying things. They occur in rows because they're not really connected, they can't really feel, and they're basically used until they're worn out, and they're held in the soft tissue in almost like a conveyor belt style, where the teeth come out and they fall out once they get to the end, and then new teeth sort of arrive. I think the glowing reaction in this case is actually taking place in the gum underneath the teeth. So I think that they're... So in veterinary medicine, if we're looking for problems associated with the teeth, we can do something called transillumination, where I actually hold up a light source right next to the tooth, and I can see a lot of the inner structures of the tooth. You can see through teeth pretty easily. So I think it makes much more sense in this situation that these creatures have built their teeth for the purposes of just munching and crunching everything, knowing that they're going to break and get destroyed and get hurt really easily. So they don't have great pain sensation in those teeth.
Would you say that they're ass munchers?
What?
A lot of animals eat corpses butt first.
Moving on.
Into the chicken.
Now, Adam.
You should have explained that, Adam. That makes sense now.
I had a little
context is everything.
Right. So they're going to have some sort of system where underneath the gum there's going to be a specialized organ. It's going to be producing a biofluorescence that basically shines through the teeth as the teeth start to move. Now, the biofluorescence reaction in fireflies is actually really heavily regulated. They add oxygen as needed, the same way that you might add fuel to a fire to keep it going, to make sure that that reaction is controlled. And when they die, that fluorescence tends to stop very quickly. And we see the exact same thing in these creatures, where once they pass and that mechanism has been broken for regulation, the teeth stop glowing because they're no longer feeding fuel into the fire. They're going to need like a specialized material to see through, but it's actually not that difficult to build. I did some calculations last night and it works. Now, Adam had suggested an alternative idea, and I just want to talk about it briefly, which was fungal growth on top of the teeth. Because certain fungal organisms can glow and produce biofluorescence. I think it's a cool idea. You could have a symbiotic relationship, but they would brush off as you're chewing. You'd have to coat each tooth in the biofluorescence, and it wouldn't turn off or go down after the organism had died.
What about, I know that Komodo dragons have an incredibly diverse array of bacterial communities in their mouth, and that was part of the reason that why for the longest time people thought that they were poisonous and not venomous, because it was just... They'd bite you and you'd get
die.
All this sickness. Yeah, and it would just take you a day, and they would just follow you while you'd waited to die. But now they did find they do have a venom gland in their bottom jaw. But anyway, for this community, you have this just crazy array of bacteria that happens to be bioluminescent as part of their reaction. And maybe it's a type of organism that has evolved to be incredibly fast living, and it just needs a really, really constant supply of maybe nutrients or some kind of... maybe some kind of membrane transfer between the gums and themselves. And so as soon as they kind of die, that goes away and they just slowly die right in front of your eyes.
Wouldn't really work, because you have to evolve single organisms to survive for at least periods of their own underneath it. They would also brush off even with the biting. It's really hard to adhere to teeth effectively. I mean, we get plaque and calculus. You do get like bacterial layers, but it would be hard
for single organisms to survive. And we don't see any glowing bite marks on anybody.
No, that's exactly it. We'd get transfer between them. I think it makes much more sense to just have a glowing organ underneath the teeth that shines through, creating this. Now, the exact reason is something I'm excited to see what you guys come together with. Last couple of quick points. Their coat is like super dark black. It completely absorbs light. You can totally do this in nature. There's a number of animals that basically exist with what we call a very high melanistic composition. A really good example is the black seal. They're like dark, dark, dark. Like you put your hand up to it. And that just works on the idea of wavelengths, that basically you are in a system where you have a very dark pigment, usually something with a carbon base that just absorbs the light around it.
When you say black seal,
yeah,
I can't find anything on the Brit species.
There should be a group. I was looking it up yesterday.
Yeah, I've never heard of this animal before. I know it was a big story a couple years ago that the scientist had made like the darkest dart that had ever been made artificially, and it looks just like the fur of these creatures.
That thing was fantastic. When that happened, there was that guy who bought the rights to it,
mm-hmm.
and then made it prohibitively expensive for other people to work with. So there was a rival engineer who created the exact same shade of black and made it like available for everybody to work with for like next to nothing except for that one guy.
Yeah. you can also see that hypermelanization in nature where it's the, I can't remember the name of the condition, but it's like the opposite of albinism where you have these incredibly dark animals. And maybe in this population, it's just with the fixation.
Yeah, I mean, usually that's skin more than hair, and that's what I was playing with last night. We get lots of really dark black skin cases in reptile species and certain other types of creatures. It's just creating, just like, dark black fur is a little bit more difficult. These creatures climb. I imagine they're using similar shoulder joints and similar, like, support systems to what we'd see in gorillas or bears, but I didn't really have any problems with the creatures this week. Very cool, a lot of fun, voracious eaters.
What about, maybe you can touch on this briefly, but their gait when they're running, they really seem to have kind of that gorilla, like, lumbering, like, the front legs don't really match up with their back legs, and it looks like they might at some times be more comfortable standing upright, but then when they move, it's that big trundling gait where their front legs are kind of off to the side and their back legs are off to the other side.
Yeah, they've got a very unusual body plan in that, like, when they're climbing up, their body plan seems to shift into, like, a much longer gait. They're almost taking up, like, a gorilla-type position, but they don't have the right hands for climbing. Those big claws that they have attached aren't going to allow good manipulation for, like, moving up or down surfaces. And their running posture seems to vary quite drastically between different positions, and I don't get a good view of their back legs through all the dark hair. That's a really good method from a director or creator perspective to hide your creatures from scientific criticism, to just be like, I'm going to make it so dark that you can't see it and you guys can't do shit.
Cause the female, for sure, she's got like almost human looking feet.
Yeah.
Her hands are like really like spindly, kind of really gripping things, but the feet she does. And that'll lend a bit of credibility to the theory that Adam and I have, that the males and females occupy very different habitats.
Yeah,
but I mean, because the males are obviously very capable climbers.
Yeah, and they seem to be able to move up. They're also very quick. And again, I just had a lot of trouble actually assessing their body plan through the fit, because there were moments I was watching and I'm like, they're a bear. That's 100%. That's your sedate movement. Like, that's clear. That's bear. Yeah. And then, like, they would switch, and they'd be running in a slightly different way, and I'm like, shit, that's primate. Like, that looks more gorilla.
Because the best running scene where, like, where Moses is booking it down that corridor, and they're chasing after him, that is, like, a full-on gorilla, like, the gorilla kind of run. Yeah, James McAvoy in Split sort of thing.
Yeah.
No, that's the dumb human-dog run.
Yeah.
There's a fair amount of alteration in terms of, like, how they're running. But generally speaking, I'm happy with them having something between, like, a bear and a primate body plan, probably closer to a gorilla. I do like the gorilla wolf motherfucker comment. No visual, so as we said, sort of tracking their way through the world. But I didn't have a lot to attack or go after, and I could only work on what I could see in this film. So, Yeah, so I'm sorry this is a little bit short this week.
That's not a problem at all.
Nope.
What Dave said has lent, like, because we were talking about this earlier, and obviously there's no way they could have survived a trip through space.
Not even.
It's no fun if we just say, look, they've been genetically engineered by the government. So, you know, what our prevailing theory is that perhaps these were found off-world in another, you know, star system and brought to Australia and aimed at the lower economic classes to wipe everything out. It's kind of like the plot of the movie The First Purge.
Australia. They were brought to Australia.
Lower economic classes.
Okay. Oh, right. Yeah. Cut that out.
Yeah. But yeah, I think that, yeah, what Moses has said about, like, the government being, first they sent drugs, then they sent weapons, now they've sent aliens. Yeah, good point. Might have been what
right.
happened.
And I think you guys will get into this, obviously, next week. And if we can, we have an extra minute for just talking on it. The way that you would have to build their entry system, where they're coming in and it looks like they're activated probably by entry through the atmosphere to sort of warm them up.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're coming in, that shell starts to break away, and then they strike with a type of material that's going to break apart, absorb the impact, and protect the creature inside, while also disintegrating itself enough for the creature to exit and not really create a loud, like a big impact or, you know, force that's basically moving away from it, like a blast radius. That you don't get that in nature. There's yeah. no way to engineer that. This had to have been something that was built and fired. Whether or not yeah. it was fired by another species at Earth, somebody from outside, I'm not ruling out aliens that were just really pissed off or weren't aiming for Earth and accidentally hit us by mistake. Because we only see yeah. one of these things land. If you were using it like a weapon, you'd be sending a lot of these, and they could be a decent weapon.
And they do. There's they like are. 30 or 40 of these things.
They are
but
tough.
To be fair, like, these things aren't going to wipe out a country. Like,
I mean, it depends on how many you hit with. If you hit with, like, incredible large quantities that came down in multiple urban areas and then just started mating and reproducing like mad, because we don't know what their reproduction rate looks like.
It would be slow.
And they were able... But depending, if they have been engineered, we don't know what their gestation cycle might look like, especially yeah. considering these things eat constantly. They're running into yeah. human after human after human. A normal lion would be taking time to sort of like enjoy the prey to stop. These things just eat and then move on to the next eat.
Yeah, we should get into this maybe next week, because I have some theories about that, yeah.
Okay.
I do think they have short generation times and high metabolism. But I also think that a lot of it is just they're just killing things that get in their way.
Yep. Yeah.
Or that they perceive as threats. Like they're not, they wouldn't
they're not eating
that much normally.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Sweet. Yeah. I'm happy. Yeah. I didn't talk that much this week. You guys don't get to make fun of me this time.
Yeah. Dogs. Dogs with climbing adult jaws. Dogs with no eyes. Dogs the size of gorillas. You think them things are dogs?
Sounds good.
Dave, all right. You've well done, Dave. Good to have a shorter session. Anyway, you got a PSA for us?
Yeah, my PSA this week was going to be fractures, just because this is one of these like terrible situations. So if Sam is an idiot and he goes outside and he breaks his limb, he goes to the doctor does their best to sort of reduce the fracture to move the bone into the right places, and then place a cast over it. Sam then takes a couple of days off, he's easy on that limb, he catches up on Game of Thrones, he does whatever it is that Sam does during his downtime. Dogs really don't cast well. They don't have a great wrist to place a cast on. They tend to not really take the time off. They're not easy to keep inactive and sort of keep in a position to allow the bone to knit and to go back together. And just because of the way that, unfortunately, we bred a lot of these animals, the bone that we have to work with is not thick, it's not great, it runs into all kinds of problems. So we frequently see small dogs or other dogs coming in with major fractures associated with certain bones. Certain bones are amenable to splints or to casts to try and get them, but a lot of them aren't. A lot of them we have to have a discussion that either we're going to have to surgically go in and fix the bone in place, so that means putting a plate in. That requires incredible equipment, it requires incredible training, and it's really hard to do, to try and go in and like connect and attach a bone in the proper place. Or we have to consider amputation. And this is a big issue for a lot of people that come in and are expecting us just to put a cast on a broken limb, and we have to start into this discussion. If your animal fractures, be prepared that you're walking into something that's probably going to need a referral surgeon to take a look at it, an orthopedic specialist, and we're talking around $5,000 to $6,000. Now this can be a big hit on a lot of people and it just sort of comes out of nowhere. But the equivalent surgery in human medicine to have a human surgeon cut it is around $32,000. So, Yeah, you're getting a little bit of a bargain here, but this is one of the biggest things where we have people that come in that get shell-shocked, that get very angry at us, that get into a big thing of like, well, why can't you just... It's not that we don't want to cast it, we wish that we could. It's just a lot of times we try and the bone continues to move, it doesn't knit properly, it doesn't come together, and you just end up with basically a non-healing fracture, something that isn't going to connect. We're just trying to be honest and explain the situation, and you need to know that going in to see your vet, what you might be walking into.
Cool.
Awesome.
All right. Cheers, Dave. Adam, do you want to bring us, wrap us up, baby?
Baby? Oh,
sorry, it's baby,
yeah.
Time.
What do you call your, male?
Baby?
I'm not calling Sam hookup. Baby.
Potential hookups. No.
Jesus.
Cut that out. Okay. So you can follow Sam and I on Twitter. Sam is at Sam Perrin, NTNU. I'm at Hassock Adam. You can follow the podcast at C_Animalia. Check out our website, cinematicaanimalia.com. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, or suggestions for new monsters, shoot us an email at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. If you want to see more of the ecology stuff that Sam and I do away from the podcast, more research-based, check out ecologyforthemasses.com. And remember, the monsters aren't real, but the science is.
See you next week.
See you guys.